Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we interview philosophers about their books in ethics, metaphysics, epistemology, philosophy of mind, and many other areas. Today's interview is with Michael Strevens, Professor of Philosophy at New York University. We're talking about his new book, Tychomancy, Inferring Probability from Causal Structure, which is just out from Harvard University Press. When we're faced with a choice between door number one, door number two, and door number three, how do we infer correctly that there's an equal chance of the prize being behind any of the doors? How is it that we are generally correct to choose the shorter of two checkout lines in the supermarket when we're in a hurry? Strevens argues that we are all equipped with a reliable, probably innate, and not fully conscious skill at probabilistic reasoning, a physical intuition that enables us to infer physical probabilities from perceived symmetries. This skill, Strevens argues, is found in six-month-old infants watching as red and white balls are removed in different proportions from an urn. But it also underlies important advances in sciences, such as James Clerk Maxwell's reasoning when he hit upon the correct distribution of velocities of a moving particle in a gas. In this intriguing essay on a very special type of cognitive capacity, Strevens defends controversial claims about the rules guiding our reasoning about physical probability, its probable innateness, and its role in science as well as in everyday judgment. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Michael Strevens.
Hello.
Hi. Nice to have you on New Books in Philosophy.
Well, it's great to be on the show. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah. I'm eager to talk about your new book, Tychomancy, or as you helpfully describe in the cover, The Divination of Chances. And this is an account of the nature of what you call physical intuition, in this case an innate skill, according to you, at probabilistic reasoning. Based on a principle of physical indifference. And there's a lot of controversial claims that you make about this reasoning skill, some of the rules that govern it, its role in scientific reasoning and everyday reasoning, its innateness and its truth conduciveness. So I'm hoping we will get to all of those points in the course of the interview. But before we get into the actual content of the book, it's always interesting to start with a question about how you got to philosophy and to this particular topic and to the writing of this book.
Well, I got to philosophy through a process of ever-increasing abstraction. Whatever I was studying, I wanted to study the foundations of it. So I ended up, in the end, although I'd started out as a mathematics, computer science, physics major at college, staying on for an extra year or two and becoming a philosophy major. First of all, interested in philosophy of mind, and at that time, teleosemantics, and therefore evolutionary explanation. From there to the role of probability in evolutionary explanation, and from there to some of the issues that I discuss in the book.
So you start with a puzzle, and you present the puzzle in terms of the reasoning of a very famous episode in the history of physics from James Clerk Maxwell, when he was reasoning towards a claim about certain velocity distributions of a particle in a gas. And you go through what you call the official derivation of his conclusion, and then the unofficial derivation. And it's the second one on your view that really illustrates the sort of reasoning, which you call equiprobabilistic reasoning, that is the real derivation, sort of the even if it's unofficial, behind how he hit upon the right distribution. So maybe you could start us off by sort of going through the example and explaining, you know, what you mean by equiprobabilistic reasoning and micro equiprobabilistic reasoning and equidynamical reasoning.
Sure. Well, there's really just one kind of reasoning, which I call equidynamical reasoning. So that's the kind of reasoning where you look at the causal or physical structure of something, and that could be something as complicated as a society, but in Maxwell's case, we're just thinking about little particles whizzing around in a box, and you make some inferences about the probabilities of different events occurring. The contrast is with statistical reasoning, where you simply keep a track of how often something happens and from that infer a probability. So on the one hand, you're observing some event and assuming that it will continue to happen about as often in the future as it happens in the past. That's statistical reasoning. Then equidynamic reasoning, you are not looking at the statistics, but looking at what brings about those statistics and inferring probabilities from those facts. So Maxwell, at a time when the kinetic theory of gases was just being revived. So for a long time, it was the caloric theory which had been worked on, the idea that that heat is some sort of fluid, and that things like the heat in gases should be understood. So just what makes a gas hot should be understood as a kind of a certain quantity. That theory, which had been mathematically worked out and in some ways very carefully, was falling by the wayside in favor of the old kinetic theory, which was the favorite in the 17th century. Now it's the 1800s. For the kinetic theory, where the heat in a gas is just the kinetic energy of these little particles flying around in the box at enormous speeds, banging into things. So that's as I say, an old picture of what was going on in the gas. What Maxwell managed to do was make it quantitative by thinking about the probabilities with which the particles would take on certain velocities or be found in certain positions. And to do that, he had to think about the probabilities of these microscopic particles in a position where no one was able to make any observation of their properties. So the statistical way of reasoning was just closed off to him. The only way to make inferences about these probabilities was to think about whatever it was that was bringing about the properties that was causing them to travel at this or that velocity or be in such and such a position, which meant thinking about the probabilities related to collisions, because it's collisions between particles which spread them around the box, give them their velocities, and so on. How's that so far?
Yeah, that's fine.
So he, in a famous passage in just a few paragraphs, he derives a very a pretty simple form for the probability distribution of the velocities of the particles in a gas, which turned out to be absolutely correct. So this is a rather amazing thing. Without actually taking any measurements, just thinking about how the whole thing works, he manages to infer not just a distribution, but what turns out ultimately to be the correct distribution, although he had no way of checking it at the time. A remarkable thing. It points to some kind of power that Maxwell had to get from the physical facts of collisions. So he just thought about these particles as little balls flying around and bouncing off one another like billiard balls on a 3D table. Some power to get from that to the probabilities. One possibility is that Maxwell was just a super smart physics genius kind of guy, so he was able to do things that ordinary mortals can't do. What I argue in my book is that, in fact, we all have the power to make these kinds of inferences. What made Maxwell special was not that he was able to make a new kind of inference, but that he applied his reasoning skills in a very advanced way to a problem that nobody had really thought about before.
Well, okay, so this does get to a first sort of question I had was, the one response is to think, well, you know, he got lucky. I mean, or at least if he didn't just get lucky, he had certain knowledge base that he was relying on that pointed him towards the truth. The question is basically, it seems like he could have gone through the very same reasoning processes, and that the world might not have, you know, been that way. And so the question, I suppose, is why think this ability that we have to reason probabilistically is truth conducive? And I can put the worry in terms of, you know, so more popular terms, in terms of Daniel Kahneman's recent book on thinking fast and slow. I mean, the way you describe our capacity for equiprobabilistic reasoning, it seems to belong to the fast, you know, not rational, not truth-conducive system. So what is it that makes it reasonable or reliable? What is it that ensures that it does actually get us or Maxwell to the truth, as opposed to him just having gotten lucky or relied on other background information?
Mm-hmm. Let me give you a short answer and then a slightly longer answer.
Sure.
So the short answer is that these System 1 style processes, the kind of thinking that happens, but that we don't seem to consciously control or direct or even necessarily fully understand the principles of, that kind of reasoning is off. Kahneman is famous for showing how that kind of reasoning sometimes leads to bad results. But he himself believes, Kahneman believes, that it usually, when it's applied in normal context, leads to good results. If it didn't, we would all be dead. Mm-hmm. So there's some prima facie reason to think that this reasoning will work most of the time in normal situations, even though it does have more kinship with System 1 reasoning than with System 2 reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Now the longer answer, well, Maxwell wasn't applying it in a normal situation. He was sitting in his study looking at some pieces of paper thinking about molecules that are too tiny for the eye to see. Why does it work there too? Was he just lucky? I think he was lucky in some ways. He was just speculating that the molecules of gases would act like little round balls. Now, most gas molecules are not, in fact, spherical, but non-spherical molecules have enough of the same properties in their collisions as spherical molecules. So the results he derived for the spherical case also hold in the non-spherical case, as long as the geometry isn't too crazy. Was that luck, or did he see that the arguments could be extended? There, I don't really know. As you remarked when you first mentioned Maxwell, the manuscript, well, this paper, which started as a talk, has a more complicated structure than you would think. There's one way to read it where it seems Maxwell is just conjecturing, and on that reading, it really does seem like he's happily blundered into the right result. But a part of the point of this book is to read the paper a little bit more closely and find what I call the alternative derivation, the unofficial derivation, where some other stuff is going on that I don't think is guaranteed to lead to the truth, but that is quite a bit more secure. So it's a complicated story. There's aspects of luck, and there's aspects of not luck, but the systematic application of principles that usually work. Mm-hmm. Maxwell was lucky, but he wasn't just lucky. He was making his luck.
Okay. Let me go into an important piece of the total story that you go into in the, I think it's the third chapter, where you draw attention to a, you know, important distinction that was eventually made in the history of probability between, you know, physical probability and epistemic probability. And then you go on to defend a corresponding distinction between two principles of indifference, right? A physical indifference principle and then the epistemic one, and you sort of set the epistemic one aside. So can you explain those indifference principles, or the one that you're going to focus on at least? And also the question, you know, are they really independent sort of principles, or is it that physical indifference, you know, depends on, you know, in some sense, since it depends on, I think, our total ignorance of a particular situation, you know, that seems to be some sort of an epistemic state.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the physical indifference, which is what I rename it, equidynamics, in the hope of getting away from the idea that total ignorance is a precondition. Mm-hmm. Physical indifference is an inference from specific information about a system, its causal structure, to further physical information about the system, the values of certain probabilities. So I look at balls bouncing around in a box, and I infer a certain probability distribution over their velocities, if I'm clever enough, as Maxwell was. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting from in that case, relatively specific information about the box. Now, parenthetically, Maxwell, of course, did not have that information. He was just speculating that that's the way gases looked. But right. But still, the form of the inference is to take the specific premises and derive interesting further conclusions which go beyond those premises, but which still do require a reasonable level of either knowledge or speculation, or at least a fairly strong claim about the way the system works. The classical principle of indifference, well, maybe I shouldn't call it classical, the principle of indifference as it's existed in 20th century philosophy is paradigmatically applied under conditions of total ignorance, not knowing anything at all about what's going on.
Right.
So I give as an example of this kind of thinking a case where I simply tell you that there's three doors in front of you. Behind one of the doors is a tiger. Behind another one is an endowed chair in philosophy, and there's nothing behind the third. Which door should you choose, assuming you want the chair and not the tiger, let's say? Well, you have no idea. In one sense, you have no idea. I haven't told you anything about the process by which I decided to put one thing or another behind one of the doors. Mm-hmm. Still, it seems to make sense to think that the chair is equally likely to be behind any door. Now, there I'm not using any information about physical processes. I'm just settling for a conclusion of equal probabilities, it seems, really based on total ignorance of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that kind of thinking is does play a role in human cognition. But the book isn't about that. It's about this more specific kind of reasoning where I have information and I parlay it into yet still more information, positive information. That's equidynamics.
Okay. So what are the symmetries or structural properties, you know, that to which we apply this physical indifference principle? How do we fix on the relevant sorts of symmetries or structural properties?
Well, it's complicated. Now, it can seem very simple. The paradigm of physical indifference reasoning is not these historical episodes I discuss in the book. By paradigm, I mean not my personal paradigm, but the philosophical paradigm. It's something like looking at a 12-sided die, mm-hmm. a dodecahedral die, and seeing that there is an equal probability when that thing is rolled of any face ending up uppermost. So there's something very striking about the object. It's total symmetry, 12 ways. And so that same symmetry turns up in the conclusion. That has gotten a lot of philosophers to think that symmetry is key, and there's some fairly simple relation between the symmetry, the physical symmetry in the object in this case, and the probabilistic symmetry, equal probabilities for each face. But I think, in fact, that's an unusual case. It's not a very good example of the kind of equidynamic reasoning that normally occurs. The key premise for Maxwell is something that's not really about symmetry per se at all. He starts from what seems to him the obvious point that the probability of a gas molecule being anywhere in a very small region of space inside the box that the gas is notionally in is uniform. That is, if you take a small enough space, the particle is equally likely to be anywhere in that space. Then he thinks about the dynamics of a collision between one particle and another. So he imagines one particle is going to collide with the other. He uses this assumption of equal probability over very small areas. That's what I call micro equiprobability. He uses that idea to figure out what the probability distribution will be over a molecule's velocity after such a collision. And that, I think, is actually a lot closer to the kinds of inferences that most often occur in equidynamical thinking. That is, you take a fairly weak assumption about initial probabilities, which comes from this suite of equidynamic principles, and then you apply it to some kind of physical interaction, which doesn't have to have anything specifically symmetrical about it, although that always makes the reasoning a bit easier, and draw some conclusion about the probability distribution over what happens next. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit more to it than that, but here in answering this particular question, I really want to emphasize that I think the right in understanding physical indifference, it's a good idea to move away from the assumption that it's all based on physical symmetries.
Okay, because one of the questions I did have was, you know, once we get beyond, say, the scientific examples, you know, if this is an innate, and we'll get to that in a second, capacity that we all have, then presumably it's something that we apply to a lot of, you know, day-to-day probabilistic reasoning, which is not, you know, for most people, you know, questions about, you know, dice or right. particles in a box. You know, it's right. it's more like, you know, will they have that in black or something like that. And so the scope question is, you know, for ordinary people using this capacity, where there aren't, I guess, these symmetries, how would this work?
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is about the scientific cases, right. and not the everyday cases. I have a few pages on that at the end. What's an example of an everyday case of equidynamic reasoning? Here's one. Suppose I'm at the airport and I have a tight connection and I have to get from one end of the terminal to the other. Here's a question. Shall I take one of those little moving platform things? Or if I do that, is there too high a chance of being stuck behind someone slow?
Yes.
Should I just
push them out of the way?
That's not equidynamic reasoning. That's something else entirely. Well, one factor that's going to come into my thinking is I'm going to think the more people that are on one of these moving things. What are they called, by the way? People conveyor belts?
Yeah, I think so.
Moving walkways?
Yeah.
The more likely I am to be stuck behind a slow person, or if I'm choosing between two of these things, I'll choose the one with fewer people on it. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because I'm thinking that there's a certain number of slow people at the airport. As they approach the ramps, they'll be somewhat spread out. They'll be equally likely to be on the left or the right. They don't really care what ramp they take. And so they're equally likely to get on one or the other. So there'll be equal proportions of slow people on both, roughly speaking. Mm-hmm. That means I should take the less populated one, because that way I'll encounter fewer slow people.
Okay.
So that's making a big deal out of something that seems very simple and straightforward. But these processes of reasoning that are somewhat automated do all seem very simple and straightforward until you try to think about how we could possibly be making these calculations, and they turn out to be not so easy. So this is a case where you have something a little bit like Maxwell's initial assumption that people are spread out. Mm-hmm. In this case, actually, symmetrically. And then you think about the dynamics, in this case, not the physical dynamics, but the psychological dynamics of the choice between the two moving belts. And you think the slow people at least are indifferent to which one they take. Mm-hmm. And you reason accordingly from there.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
So people in crowds are, I think, one place where we use this kind of reasoning. We also use it for physical things.
Okay.
I can talk more about that if you like.
Yeah. Well, let's, I want to, you know, you go through a number of the specific rules that comprise this capacity. But I want to first, because you address it earlier, the issue of basically the innateness of this capacity. And you do that by going through some very interesting experiments in infant cognition, where you have 6 months old infants or a little bit older looking at particular events of drawing balls of different colors from containers and you know, measuring their looking time and are they expressing surprise or not. So maybe you can explain, you know, a little bit about those experiments and how, you know, that supports your claim that these abilities are innate in some sense.
Sure. Let me say first, as a kind of preface, that mm-hmm. that the really important claim in the book is not that this ability is innate, but that it's universal, that we all have it.
Mm-hmm.
So innateness is an explanation for the fact we all have it, but I don't think I'm too much of the book hinges on mm-hmm. the innateness. But nevertheless, it's very difficult to ignore this, to me, quite surprising evidence that extremely young children, 6 months old, essentially, little babies who can they can't find their way around the world. They're barely they've just started smiling and looking around, really, that they already seem to be thinking equidynamically. That is, they can do the equivalent of looking at the 12-sided die and seeing that each face is equally likely. Now, in this particular experiment, what you have is drawings from an urn rather than die rolling. So what seems to be going on is these babies see a drawing from an urn containing many red balls and just a few white balls, and they expect the sample that's drawn to be mostly red, vice versa. If it's mostly white and just a few red balls, they expect the sample to be mostly white. Rather amazing, really. There's more, too. They're sensitive to how the balls are drawn. If the experimenter seems to be rummaging around looking for certain balls, then they stop assuming that the balls are randomly drawn, as far as we can tell. Whereas if the same researcher is blindfolded so they can't see what they're choosing, then they go back to thinking it's all random.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's we're inferring from various metrics that that's effectively what they're thinking.
Right. Well, this can't
exactly report to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was one of the questions, you know, I had. I mean, there's certainly, you know, when you're measuring looking time differences, and these are interpreted as violation of expectation. That seems to be, you know, that's a pretty standard psychological interpretation of looking time differences. But it seems like you want to claim that this is that they're actually kind of generating some sort of inferences, or they're making inferences, they're generating hypotheses. And I was just wondering if, you know, you might say a bit more about that, what seems to be somewhat of an additional interpretation of the looking time differences.
Well, nobody is interested in looking time per se. So every developmental psychologist who uses looking time is making some further inference about what the infant is expecting to see. So in this case, what they're expecting is a sample that roughly reflects the composition of the urn. Are they thinking probabilistically? Well, I think the urn studies, or at least the little bit of them that we've talked about, is not enough to show this, but there's further studies having to do with one-off events, so in effect a drawing of a single ball, and so on, and yet still more stuff where the balls themselves are manipulated, so some of them are sticky, they stick to the sides of the urn. That really strongly suggests that any conclusion that an adult will make about these drawings will also be made by an infant, or maybe, to be a little bit more cautious, the infant will act as though it's drawing those conclusions about probabilities.
Well, so you draw a distinction, you know, at the very beginning between statistical thinking and probabilistic thinking. And in these experiments, the infants are first, you know, shown balls and so forth, right? So they're given they're trained in a certain way before they're actually tested. Right. And so why would this be probabilistic rather than statistical?
You mean equidynamic rather than statistical?
Yeah.
Because what they don't get shown is actual drawings. So in other words, they don't see that drawing after drawing from the mostly red urn produces mostly red balls. The most reasonable thing to think is that they are simply not familiar with this kind of setup. Now maybe that's wrong. Maybe they have learned from some past experience that it's just the case that the proportion of balls drawn from the urn tends to reflect the proportion in the urn. It's still pretty difficult to explain why they modify their expectations based on such things as whether the experimenter is blindfolded or not, or whether the balls have little Velcro pads on them that make them stick to the urn. If they really, at 6 months old, have enough experience to inductively make all of those inferences, I would be astonished.
Maybe, but I mean, I'm just sort of playing devil's advocate here. What an empiricist would say is that, you know, well, actually, you know, the input is quite rich. They have all kinds of experience. I mean, it's the same sort of debate that you have over language, right? You know, do we have a innate language acquiring module, or is there enough information in the input for infants to derive certain principles of syntax and so forth from the, you know, statistically from the input? And I would assume that these same experiments could be interpreted that way as well, especially given how on both cases, in both senses, there's richness in the result. and there needs to be an explanation of that richness. And you seem to be, you want to go with, you know, the richness of the reasoning rules inside, and an empiricist would want to go with the richness of the input.
Well, I should point out that an empiricist could still give an equidynamic interpretation of this reasoning. So you could think, you could, on the one hand, be an empiricist about equidynamics and say that rules of equidynamics are learned, but then say in these cases that the infants are not using their previous experience with urns and Velcroed balls. They're actually thinking their way through the case using the rules of equidynamics. Mm-hmm. And really, it's that last part I care about.
Right.
What I really care about is that ordinary people and scientists alike have this ability to think equidynamically, whether they learn that ability or simply inherit it, is less important to me.
Okay, yeah, you did mention that before, and that's...
Although I do give the... I do opt for native... It seems to me that nativism is the more likely explanation, but it wouldn't be... It wouldn't undermine any of the major theses of the book if it turned out that the rules of equidynamics are learned.
Okay. So let's get to those rules. So in the middle section of the book, you have a couple of chapters on what you call stirring, shaking, bouncing, and unifying, in which you go through, you explain each of the elements of what you call the equilibrium rule package. So maybe you could explain, you know, exactly in more detail the rules that make up this probabilistic reasoning skill.
Well, maybe it's... It might take a little bit too long to go through each rule and explain how it works.
That's okay, yeah.
But I can explain the kinds of it. Maybe I'll talk about three kinds of rules. Okay. One is the kind of rule that I've already talked about quite a bit, where that simply allows you to make an assumption like Maxwell's assumption that over very small areas, probabilities will be roughly equal. Okay, so mm-hmm. that even if the probability distribution is not uniform in the large, still little chunks of it will be roughly uniform, which turns out to, even though it's not a very strong assumption, to be quite useful if you then think about the dynamics of certain processes that depend on very small differences in initial conditions, like collisions between molecules. That's one kind of equidynamic rule, the rule that gives you something, maybe just a weak something to get started on in thinking about probabilities. Then another kind of rule is a long-term rule. The equilibrium rule is one of these. It tells you certain circumstances that you can assume that a probability distribution will settle down and assume a certain fixed form. Okay. Now, I said the first kind of rule had an interestingly weak output. And this one, too, has a somewhat weak output. It tells you that in such and such circumstances that the distribution will settle down, but it doesn't tell you what it will settle down to. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, as I show with the case of Maxwell, just knowing it will settle down can allow you, if you're clever, to derive some consequences there and then. And even if you're not clever, knowing that there's a single fixed probability distribution allows you to do regular statistical inductive inference. You know, once the probability distribution is settled down, that statistics that you measure right now will be accurate guides to what will happen in the future. So it solves on a very small scale the problem of induction, if you like, telling you that in certain cases it's okay to project future performance from present and past performance.
Okay.
I think I said I would mention one more kind of rule,
yeah,
but I don't need to do that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
All right. One more rule that I call the uniformity rule actually allows you in certain more specific cases where these probabilities have settled down to assume that the distribution really is uniform. Uh-huh. So equal probability, for example, of a gas molecules traveling in any direction would be an example of this. Or maybe in a crowd, under certain circumstances, there's an equal probability of a certain person's facing in any direction. Mm-hmm. You can see that's not always going to be true. Part of the trick is to give some fairly general conditions under which it will be true. So that gives you some sense of the kind of rules mm-hmm. that are being used here.
Okay. In later chapters, then you turn to, you know, away from the, sort of the physical cases, and you turn to biology, mm-hmm. and you use evolutionary theory as mm-hmm. an example of how we use the capacity to generate good theories. So maybe you can explain the application of your outlook to the case of biology and evolution.
Well, what I do for the most part in these chapters is to look at the passage, the chapter in really the beginning of the chapter in which Darwin first introduces the notion of natural selection mm-hmm. in The Origin of Species. And he uses these two examples. What he's trying to do is persuade people that small physiological differences can lead to a certain persistent selective advantage, so that one variant does, even if it just does a little better than the other variant, continues to do better in a systematic way and eventually takes over the population. That's natural selection at work. So in Darwin's reasoning about these two cases, first of all, I show, as some of the scholars of Darwin have said before me, that Darwin is thinking probabilistically, stochastically. Mm-hmm. So it's impossible to make sense of what he's up to unless you think of him as making judgments about frequency of events that are not in any way determined by the situation, but are just very likely given the situation, namely the frequencies that constitute natural selection, one variant's doing better than another. And second, and of course this is where I'm more lighting out on my own, I try to show that the kinds of probabilistic facts, in particular the differences in probabilities that make one variant fitter than the other, Darwin is deriving equidynamically. So he's thinking about the physical or biological structure of the situation and inferring from that structure that one organism will achieve some desirable outcome with a higher probability than another.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have other – I know that was the one you kind of focused on. Do you have other examples of in biology of equiprobabilistic reasoning behind, you know, theory selection – or mm-hmm. hypothesis selection?
Yeah, so that's what I've just described as the role of equidynamics in a scientifically, obviously, very, very important argument.
Right.
But I think that the same kind of thinking is important for model construction all the time. So uh-huh. when you're building a model of some complicated system, even just a gas, but certainly an ecosystem, you're leaving about 99.999% of what's going on in the system out of your description. Mm-hmm. Your model is only going to work if what you leave out is irrelevant to the kinds of behavior you're interested in. Mm-hmm. So you need to have some kind of criterion for deciding, even before you start doing the science, because here you're just putting together a model for the first time perhaps, some kind of criterion for deciding what's likely to be relevant and what's not. Of course, it's too much to ask that you have a criterion that is infallible. You just want one that allows you to do a lot better than guessing randomly. So this problem is a problem that I think is solved by physical intuition of all sorts, not just equidynamic intuition. So whether it's physics or biology or social science, scientists are able to use their grasp, their intuitive grasp of the way things work to rule out some things as, or not rule out, maybe I should say, but to think that some things are very unlikely to be important and others are much more likely to be important, that some things they ought to keep track of and other things they don't really have to keep track of. So if you're in the biological case, it seems to make sense to keep track of population number, or maybe that's what you're interested in keeping track of, but it seems okay to leave out such details as where particular individual organisms are, or even different distributions of the different sexes or something like that. I think one of Darwin's examples where he's talking about the evolution plants using nectar to attract pollinating insects has some of this character. There's a lot of stuff he leaves out in the little scenario he sketches that he knows he can probably leave out because of equidynamic thinking, because of the probabilistic irrelevance of these factors to the changes in frequencies that he's really interested in.
So So you don't really discuss in the book these sort of determinations of relevance, and that seems to be, that wasn't the topic of the book. It's more about however it is that we determine which features are relevant, which are the symmetries we want to focus on, then we apply this probabilistic reasoning to it. Do you have anything to say maybe about what determines the structural properties that we do somehow fix on?
Well, some of it isn't equidynamic at all.
Right.
But here are some examples of things that you might rule out. I'll give you. Let me see. Maybe I should just give you one example. So let's say we're thinking about predators and prey. If I want to know how the number of prey will change, what do I have to know about the predators? Seems pretty obvious. The number of predators will matter a lot. What about the particular positions of the predators? After all, whether something gets eaten or not depends on the position of a particular predator. But still, I can reason probabilistically about this in roughly the same way I reason about the crowds at the airport. If I assume that the predators take on some fixed probability distribution or other, the predators' positions take on some fixed probability distribution or other over the longer term. So there's given a certain number of predators, there's a certain probability that doesn't change much that I'll run into a predator here or a predator here or a predator here, then I don't need to track in my model the positions of individual predators. This probability distribution is going to be enough to tell me how likely encounters are in particular places. And in fact, I can even abstract away from that if I have some statistics and just assume that for a fixed number of predators and prey, the rate of capture will be much the same regardless of fluctuations in particular positions, because it's really that probability distribution that matters, and that probability distribution, whatever it is, is not changing.
Okay. To continue in the biological and in fact psychological vein, towards the end of the book, you make a very interesting claim. Behind every great deterministic theory in the biological and social sciences is a stochastic and equidynamic rationale. And I was just wondering if you might elaborate on that claim. There doesn't seem to be, at least on the surface, very many deterministic theories in biology or the social sciences. So could you explain that remark?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I should first of all say it's not the case that the equidynamic rationale is the only rationale. It's one of several rationales that prop up the theory. So the equidynamics does some work. It doesn't do all the work.
Okay.
But what I'm thinking is this, that there are quite a few deterministic theories. I mean, the reality is not deterministic, but except maybe at the level of particles, but there are quite a few deterministic theories. So in population ecology, for example, it's not at all uncommon to have deterministic equations in your models saying how the predator and prey populations will change. In population genetics, there's a deterministic version of the theory, which seems to which works pretty well for certain kinds of problems. In the social case, although it is normal to put in an error term or something like that, that's usually put in on top of some underlying deterministic mm-hmm. Relation. Not that scientists necessarily think that determinism is the way it is out there, but deterministic models seem good enough much of the time. Why is that? Mm-hmm. Well, it's basically because fluctuations cancel out. So you have a lot of irregularity and stochasticity out there in the world, but the little jerks and wiggles and pulls in one direction tend to get cancelled out by the same in the other direction. And so you have systems that quite reliably, not completely reliably, follow the trajectory of the average, the expected value of these different quantities. So that is a kind of probabilistic rationale. Everything cancels out, and so what you will see is behavior that deterministically follows the average for a deterministic theory.
Okay. Let me just go back a little bit. In the book, you also present what you call your pre-formationist view of a history of the concept of probability. So those of us who are at all aware of this history, the Ian Hacking's book is pretty much the sort of the text, his The Emergence of Probability. And you think that his approach is deeply wrong, and instead defend this pre-formationist view. Mm-hmm. Could you explain your alternative history?
Well, the alternative history is in some sense that there is no history. Of course, that's not quite right. Hacking's book is about the development of the very concept of probability.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, the development of the concept of classical probability that, I suppose, reaches its apex with Laplace, but is gotten going by people like Leibniz well before Laplace, about, I guess that would be a good 100 years earlier. So this is during the 18th century. Well, the lead up to Leibniz is during the 17th century. So the thought behind Hacking's history is there was no coherent concept of probability, and then something happened that made it possible. So a classic kind of story in the history of ideas. If my view about the ubiquity of equidynamics is right, then something very much like the concept of physical probability has to have been around long before Leibniz, thousands of years before, maybe tens of thousands of years before. And so what Hacking documents, and of course he isn't just making it up, mm-hmm. what he documents can't be the emergence of probability or the concept of probability. Instead, it has to be an emergence of self-consciousness about this concept. The concept is always there. What's developed is an understanding of what concept has already been there, moving from at the beginning from a almost perhaps complete lack of awareness that the concept is there. So people are using these modes of thought without being fully aware of what those modes of thought presuppose. perhaps typical for the System One kind of stuff, to the point where not only do they know it's there, but they have elaborate mathematical and philosophical theories of it. So something is emerging for sure. Not probability, of course. Hacking thinks the concept of probability is emerging. I think our consciousness of the concept, our theory of the concept is emerging.
Okay. Let me just this. I had another question about the use of probabilistic reasoning in some theories for creationism. I think I mentioned this to you. You know, one of the things that some creationists will argue is that, you know, the probability, you know, they seem to be using probabilistic reasoning of our world just having, you know, sort of come about as a matter of chance or, you know, physical chance, whatever, is just not plausible. And so they conclude in some way with additional premises that, you know, there must have been some sort of a divine creator. Now, it seems that they're applying probabilistic reasoning, and it would seem to be the same sort of, you know, innate or in other words, in any sense, in some sense, you know, universal, sense of ability to reason probabilistically. There, one might say, well, somehow it has gone awry in some way. Mm-hmm. What would you respond to that, to somebody who argues that way using probabilistic reasoning? Is that just one of the cases where we've, you know, just gotten it wrong?
Well, I think equidynamics does provide some of the probabilistic premises, and the premises it provides are correct. Uh-huh. It's what happens next that's wrong. So I think here's a simple analogy. Suppose I'm rolling three dice. Okay. How long is it going to take me to get three sixes? Mm-hmm. Well, that depends partly on the probability of getting a six on a single die roll, which equidynamics will correctly tell me is 1 in 6. Mm-hmm. But it also depends on exactly what the rolling protocol is. So the creationists are thinking in terms of a rolling protocol where you roll all three dice every single roll. The retort from people who understand what's going on with evolution and natural selection is that's not the correct analogy for what's happening in the biological case. Instead, what's happening there is something more like this, that you roll a dice. If any of them come up six, you leave those facing six upwards and just roll the remaining ones. Do that and you'll get to three sixes a lot more quickly.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So the equidynamic part there, it's the same for both parties, and it's correct. The chance of a six is 1 in 6. It's the question of whether, as it were, nature hangs on to its sixes that they differ on. And that's not something that's resolved by equidynamics. That's okay. Where the creationists go wrong.
I see. Okay, good. We're running out of time, but I did want to ask about what your next project is. Are you working on a follow-up book to this book or something completely different?
Not a follow-up to this book. In fact, in some ways, this book is a follow-up to another book about probability and complex systems. So I think I've done enough of that for a while.
Uh-huh.
Right now, I'm working on two things. One is the question of how science works very generally, why science is so successful. And the other is a book that has nothing to do with science. It's about why philosophy is so successful. That is, how people sitting alone in darkened rooms thinking can ever come up with anything interesting and substantive to say about the world.
I think a lot of people might disagree that there is anything interesting that they are coming up with in their darkened room. I'm not one of them. But.
Right. Well, having given over my entire life to sitting in darkened rooms coming up with things, I'm also not one of them. I suppose you might think of this project as a desperate search for a rationale for my entire existence.
Okay. Well, with that, I think we're our time is up, but it's been great to talk with you about your new book.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been fun to talk about it.
Good. Okay, thanks, and bye.
Okay, bye, Carrie.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Strevens, professor of philosophy at New York University, about his new book, Tychomancy, Inferring Probability from Causal Structure, which is just out from Harvard University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and thank you for listening.